Case 52 from the Shoyu Roku, Sozan's Dharmakaya, Preface to the Assembly. All knowledgeable persons are able to learn by parable and analogy. But when comparisons cannot be made, and when it's impossible to find something similar or identical, how can it be expressed? Main case. Attention. Sozan asked Toku Joza, Buddha's true Dharmakaya is like the vast sky. It's conforming to things and manifesting shapes is like the moon in the water. How can this principle of conforming be expressed? Toku said, it's like the donkey seeing the well. Sozan remarked, well said, but that's only 80% of it. Toku rejoined, how about you, Osho? Sozan replied, the well sees the donkey. Appreciatory verse. Donkey sees the well, well sees the donkey. Wisdom contains without exception. Purity permeates more than enough. Behind the elbow, who discerns the sign? Within the house, no books are kept. Loom threads don't hang, a matter of the shuttle. Patterns emerge every which way. The intent differentiates of itself. Inside out, and my Dharma brother kindly hit me. Puck. And I thought, what's he hitting me for? And I looked down. I was just testing them. See, so inside the Raksu is a message from David to me. Actually, this Raksu was a gift from Roshi in Japan when I was at the Buddhist Association. When David got, I can't remember, it was the Inca ceremony. I thought I should give him something that really hurts, you know, not just, you know, something that I don't care about. You know, like an old stick that I wanted to get rid of anyway. something of value that would pinch me, you know, and I gave, I thought that would be, I would test my practice, a bit more princely giving. And, but anyway, so I gave him this this Raksu that I really, was very dear to me. And then later on, he gave it back to me. I thought that was... After I'd really let go of it, you know, I really gave up, you know, we have these little, funny the things we get attached to, isn't it? You know, little treasures or things that mean a great deal to us. Anyway, then he gave it back to me and he had the poem on the, wrote a poem on the inside from the liturgy that the Boundless Way people chant. And the poem says, seemed like a good place to start since I unconsciously put it on inside out. Maybe there's something to that poem I wanted to share. Maybe the poem wanted to share itself with me or with you guys. I figured there must be something going on there. So it says, just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. And then it's a sign Zen Master Deya to Zen Master Bowman. So... this place for me of stupid practicing is so very alive. It comes and goes. And so I don't like to be stupid myself. I like to, of course, we all like to dwell in the vast quiet, in the vast spaciousness of not knowing, kind of profound intelligence to that kind of not knowing. And I hope we all, I'm sure we all at this point of the retreat have tasted and have tasted the water of the well. One of the translations of this koan, which I find curious, because most of the in the Shoyuroku, this book of cases or book of encounters of self encountering itself and being both challenged and fulfilled by the encounter, both challenged and fulfilled by the encounter. One of the translations of this koan is that of the relationship between the bucket, the pulley, and the rope, and the well. So the translation is bucket and pulley, or pulley and bucket meet, see the well sees the pulley and the bucket. I don't know how they got this translation, but Chinese characters are very, very rich, filled with, you know, subtlety and different kinds of meaning, and oftentimes the meaning is revealed dependent on the context of the situation. Just our practice is the same way, you know. We the practice is always the same, but the context of the practice changes all of the time. So we are in the context of sesshin, of a training period. Some people come and go. There's a sort of a tide of reinforcements that come in and sit with us and then flow out. And then some of us are holding the space, holding the fort here, and doing in the context of retreat. But whether we go home and are with our family or whatever it is that we have to do, or whatever our karma, whatever the situation of our lives ask of us, it's different. So. You know, some people don't even come to the retreat. Well, that would probably be the majority of people. they are engaged in, they have another context for their practice, another situation, and we who are doing this a formal way of practice sit. But also as we sit, it's obvious to us as we sit that the situation of our the ta of the koan of the shikan taza changes. You know, shikan is the koan, and or truth happening, koan or the simultaneous appearance and disappearance, or the relationship between big and little, or the relationship of oneness to difference and difference to oneness. So the koan is life. This life, this one life, and there isn't anything outside of this one life. We can leave the zendo, but of course we don't leave this one life. We are endlessly encountering this endless dimension, universal life, whether we're here on the cushion or whether we're at home. Sometimes you imagine that, oh, the dreadful round of zazen was over finally. He rang that bell, I can get up and get out of here, go for a walk or stretch my legs or go out and look at my email or whatever you do out there. I don't know what you do. It reminds me, actually, I don't know if I told you this story, but we sit a lot on the... this is what I do. I sit with people. I go around the country. I mean, around, actually, not everywhere. So it's my incarnation. We sit in the mountain every month, 3 days, 5 days, or a month long, or 7 days. And then when I'm not sitting in the mountain, I go around, you know, to Seattle and Alabama, or it's in Paris, or around, up to sit with David and Sangha there, or where, and sit with people. But anyway, we don't leave our life. We just, the context of the practice just changes. We imagine that we go someplace else. Very easy to imagine. If you watch your mind, actually, at the end of a round of sitting when the bell rings, or when it's time for dinner, and you, I'm sure, like me often, you imagine that you leave the cushion and go have dinner, or you have breakfast, and it's wonderful to get off the cushion and go to... Or to, you leave the cushion to go for a walk outside, and to some extent that's true, but from another extent it's just the context of practice, especially if we're engaged in this quite intense formal practice. So then the bell rings, and that the ringing of the bell is the context of your practice. It's the ta of shikantaza. It's the case of the koan. So if we frame and we're doing formal study here, so we're doing we're looking into the curriculum of Zen, the curriculum Umankan, Hekigan Roku, and Shoyu Roku. That's the primary curriculum of Zen. And we are practicing case study introspection and Shikantaza introspection. So the Shikan, of course, is the koan, is life. And life morphs and shapeshifts endlessly due to any of the causes and conditions. So when you get up from the cushion, you morph, you shapeshift from the sitter to the eater to some degree, but it's the same life, it just takes another form. Or you shapeshift from the one who was sitting to the one who, thank God, I don't have to sit anymore. Gee, I can't take it, you know, my legs are killing me, right? And you get up, but it's just a different, the ta of the shikan changes, is the case study, but it's the same life. And since it's the same life, endless dimension, universal life that has no coming or going, and yet at the same time presents itself in different ways, we could say. Presents a magic show, that's one way, or a dream. Or however you want to frame it, there's a different ta, so it shapeshifts, and then we have a different case to study. A lot of different cases to study. And this this koan is very, very rich. We could spend the rest of our lives, or the rest of the week, or we could shift to another one, doesn't really matter. Because if you're practicing hard, it endlessly refreshes itself and illuminates itself of yourself, looking into your own, into the depths of your own mind. So the ta of the Shikantaza is the case that we, the context of practice, and it just shapeshifts all of the time, but it's just a new context for inquiry, for inquiry, or for wonder, or for awareness, or mindfulness, or possibility. And hopefully in our practicing we hold that sense of possibility as the situation of the koan changes, and all of the koan of these Mumankan, Hekigan, Roku are live places. We could say that about them. One of the reasons we study them, it's not so we can be medievalists or figure out some arcane language of, you know, this pedagogy of Zen language of. But actually they are living places, living juicy places of our life, of this one life, and they are encounters of life meeting itself in the form of, in different ways, different kinds of dialogue or inquiries or meetings or encounters. And we study them, one, because it's for self-study, in order for it not to be abducted into the habit force and just disappear into the habitual way of our lives, and then we go about our lives living in a very pretty flat, predictable, and a boring way. But we don't want to trade our boredom for too much excitement, and then sometimes we don't want to trade our excitement for too much boredom. But that's the tension of study, isn't it? Of the seven factors of enlightenment. But so the koans are a living places, and we revere them because we come from, we are practicing in, although we're pretty mongrelly in this, we're a pretty mongrel group, but nevertheless, even though the single flower is a kind of mongrel gypsy group, nevertheless we do identify with this grand ancient wisdom tradition. And so the container in which we can find it helpful to look at our lives however we choose to live, whether we live as gypsies or monks or teachers, or it's all, it's just different presentations. We revere it because these cases, these people over many, many generations have been doing what we do, and they have sung about it. Precepts or a song about an encounter with a juicy place. How do you care for your sexuality? How do you care for truth-telling? Or how do you care for not... you know, so, but the case studies are quite revered in that, because they are such juicy places, both places where we can fall down hard, and there are I suppose falling is a learning, certainly for me, the greatest learning of my life has been in falling on my face. So not that it's bad to fall. I think I've probably learned more from falling than getting up, or certainly more from, but anyway, all of these cases are the possibility of entering into more of human life and growing in love and understanding. So that's koan study. And so when we take up these cases, we want to know that they are always talking about our life, and our life is always talking about the cases. And we're quite young as students, but I suppose if we were really seasoned practitioners and we wrote down the cases of our life where we had learned and touched and were touched very deeply, or were challenged very deeply, or those places of encounter that are both opportunity and places to act out in all kinds of interesting ways, and we wrote them down, we would have the koans. We would have the Mumonkan, the Hekigan Roku, and the Shoyu Roku. We would have all of the sutras. We would have the inquiry into the moment and all of the possibilities for doing that, and the insight that comes, and so forth and so on. But we are, but because we're just normal human beings, we need a container, and we need a course of study in order to contain our wily, rascally, you know, selves, our rascally, foxy nature, as we say. I am not a human being. I'm really a fox. Once I was a human being, and now I'm a fox. So we need a container in order to study our foxy nature. It's no accident. That's the second case of the Mumonkan. First is the foundation. What are you? And second is, what is your foxy nature? What is your manifestation? And how can you study and use and become one with yourself in order to realize yourself? So that's the second case. First case, most systems of self-study is the what am I, or mu, or not knowing, or wado practice. Anyway. I wanted to say that so that we can be clear about what's the beauty of this tradition that we're studying, and these koans and cases, and the possibility and the fun of it too, to flesh it out and to fill it in with your own experience. Anyway, back to the starting place of turning my raksu inside out and appreciating this gift that I got from Tangan Harada Roshi, who is probably the Sasaki Roshi is the grand lion of Zen in America. Oh, he's 106. He became a monk when he was 14 and practiced fiercely all his life. Now he's an old man. When you hang with this guy and step into his samadhi, into his dharmakaya in Sanzen, you realize that, gee, it's really... The human spirit is capable of quite a thing. You know, it can really enter into this, into the great furnace, the great master's forge, and can manifest a quite a profound samadhi. But anyway, Tangan's one of the old guys now. He's I think he's still alive, but I think he's either has Alzheimer's or is very old, as we all. I think he has Alzheimer's. I don't know. I have friends who practice with him, but I don't think a gift from him I treasured, because I thought maybe he was drunk when he sent it to me or something, but I got it, and then I had this, so I wanted to talk a little bit about stupid practice today, and now I can get it to inside-out stupid practice, known as a gull practice. Lost practice, dense as a post, known as a gull. That kind of practice. And the importance of being stupid, and the importance of stupid practice, and how to honor being stupid and not knowing. And not just in the grand sense of not knowing, but really in the sense where we spend a great deal of time, which is numb, enshrouded in fog, or just off in another world, and then reality, you know, taps you on the shoulder. And usually when reality taps you on the shoulder, you feel a mild irritation, like, oh, David, for Christ's sake, are you trying to do some Zen trick or something? Is this some... And then you look down and you say, oh, my rocks are one inside out. How interesting. And then, of course, there's the first thing is when you're awakened, the first thing is being startled, I suppose. You know, someone comes into your room and turns the light on, and you look around, you're very bright. That's what they do in Mount Baldy, you know. They just come in. It's very, it's boot camp, you know. And so those of us who've sat there, they come and wake you up during Rahatsu or 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and they just walk in. It's no ceremony. The guy walks in, he just clicks the light on, you know. And in the cabins, it's real boot camp, so there's usually about 8 of us, and each 6, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8 in a very small cabin in bunk beds. Hopefully we got some sleep when someone wasn't snoring loudly or throwing shoes at them. So many wonderful stories of stupid practice. But anyway, the light goes on, and there's a moment of wah, and the brightness of it all, and the starkness and the suchness of it all. It's a moment of revelation, in a way, in a sense of the Dharmakaya body. It's just, boom, before you have time to think. There's the monk, there are your friends in bed, just this flash. And then, of course, after the flash, or after a Dayan taps me on the shoulder, or hits me playfully as a good friend, you wake up and you look, and there's a moment of seeing, of recognition, of knowing and seeing exactly what's going on. And it's not, it's actually even before the affect of the humor or the funniness or the enjoyment of it, or, and all, you know, all of the fun of Zen practice and all of these, you know, it's all a microcosm for our life. It's so wonderful in that way when you get into it, you know, and we're so starved for something that we start to actually get excited about our life. Maybe you have to go hungry and get, you know, hungry, and then, you know, a meal is fantastic, you know, steaming rice and color of the vegetables, or watch those little bugs go across the floor and say, how do those little guys with the little six legs run so with such incredible speed? It's quite exciting, isn't it? All of these little happenings. Like most of the time you'd say, that's a stupid bug on a squash. But anyway, and then something else happens very quickly is I'm defensive. I don't say me as opposed to you, but I want to cover my tracks, you know, and pretend that it didn't happen, you know. You know, hope nobody's looking. You know, I go, oh, just kidding, I was just testing you. Or whatever we do, you know, reality manifests itself, and then there's an embarrassment of reality. And then there's the challenge of being with the embarrassment and the edge of uncomfortableness or embarrassment or shame or, you know, whatever that crinkly feeling like, oh God, did I came to the Zendo without my pants on? David probably remembers the time during formal meals in Providence Center. I don't know if he does, but if someone lost his pants serving formal. We used to have formal meals, you know, with four bowls of usar, and you know, and the server would come around, and first you get the grain, and you get the you know, the wash water, and then you get the grain and the soup and the vegetables, and then you bow and serve. You had those big boots, the Korean monks wear, you know, those big trousers, you know, with the you know, there's room for you and three or four of you. You know. Probably put your boyfriend in there and your girlfriend. You carry on as though you were a self-respecting monk, or I don't know. But anyway, there's a lot of room. We used to call them compost trousers, and we had all kinds of wonderful nicknames for him. And he was serving and bowing, and he lost his pants. I don't know how it happened. It was a great moment. his pants fell down. He was serving. And, you know, everyone's sitting there, you know. And, you know, you're really excited about, after you've been sitting for a week or a month or however long it was, you know, you're really anything, you know, it's a captive audience. You know, that's a, you know, you even start to listen to my Dharma talks, you know, it's like nothing else going on, so I might as well, you know, perk up. And, you know, and, he's, and his pants fell off. He did it with a certain aplomb. He just pulled them up and adjusted himself and carried on. Of course, we don't know what went on inside of him. Or another wonderful moment of stupid practice was at Roshi's one. You know, we all sit on tons, and he does the Rinzai High seat. You know, and he gets up there and he's going on thumping his stick and, you know, where are you now? Well, actually, wonderful Dharma talk, and his senior monks have heard him so much that they sleep through his talks, and they just kind of, you know, like. They're like little kids, you know, who can't walk, you know. They're like eggplants, or like little persimmons bobbing, or eggplants bobbing. You know, and he's up there, and the head monk, a sweet guy, hard training guy, you know, real salt of the earth, you know. Guy is bobbing, you know, just, and I'm saying, the guy, and you're up on a ton, and he's in front of the whole assembly. You know, and there's quite a group there. There's about 40 of us, and some, you know, some pretty heavy hitters from different places are there. And he's boom, boom, and he goes right off the edge, boom, onto the floor. Fell from a good height too. And it just was bobbing. You know how it is. We all fall asleep. It's, you know, sloth and torpor is the hardest thing to deal with. And he just takes the dive. You know, right. And Roshi said, you know, went to heaven, woke up in hell, and just keeps talking. And he got back on his. So these moments of awakening that we have, it's interesting. I was noticing it this morning during practice, as I often do, that whatever you're, if you ask someone to just be present and don't do anything, they'll enact themselves in their attempt. Like if you say to somebody, just, you sit in this chair, and all you have to do, you don't have to do anything. Just be present. That's all. You don't have to do anything. Just be here. And in order for them to be here, they will enact their koan. they will enact it with beautiful precision. If they're a person more of the athletic bent, or of the A-type personality, or of a certain commitment to intensity, they will sit, or if they are a person who's more of the size of, well, there's nothing to do, so just the ease of well-being, and they kind of, they will enact themselves in their attempt to do nothing, and they will, in enacting themselves, they will, that will be their, since there is, from the perspective of koan study and shikantaza, there is only Dharmakaya, there's only Prajna and Upaya. They're enacting the perfect Upaya. They're manifesting themselves. And in manifesting themselves, it's the perfect opportunity to learn that they aren't a self. Through this self, that's a shikantaza practice. Anyway, so we, but in stupid practice, one of my wonderful stupid practices is I sit here and I'm sit in my mind, touches, you know, especially if I'm tired. I'm sure the same is true for you. You touch and go, touch and go. You say, okay, I'm really going to wake up this time. All right. And then they're gone, you know, and they, oh, damn. Okay, this time I'll really do it. You know, and then I try. I said, you know, I work out. I'm still a robust man. I can sit here and follow my... And then I... Or adrift into, you know, some dream, some wonderful dream of all of the dreams. And then I hear the cat meowing or something, or someone rings the bell or something, and I wake myself up. Some aliveness in me startles me out of my slumber. And I awaken to something, and as soon as I awaken to it, you know, David taps me on the shoulder, I fill in the blank, especially if it's... especially under certain circumstances, and I fill in the blank by enacting myself. Try harder, George. You know, look at you. Well, after all these years, you're spending your time sleeping on the cushion. Get up. Get going. Or I have that enactment in a heartbeat. I don't say it anymore. It's just a knee-jerk, visceral response. And I suppose there's something quite beautiful in it in one way, and also there's something very problematic, because I don't awaken to the moment. I awaken to my reactivity to the moment, and then I go back into the reactivity in order to be with the moment, but I was already in the moment. You see the problem. This is, oh, so David taps me, and I awaken to it, the whole thing, and my response is, and this is not good or bad, it's just the Dharma. It's the activity of study and practice, and then my response is to be defensive or to be reactive or to be embarrassed or to want to make a joke or call attention to myself or whatever, you know, whatever we do. That's a stupid practice. A stupid practicing, and it's quite a wonderful thing, in a sense, because those places of to enter into those places of stupidity, stupidity in the sense of a certain kind of numbness, perhaps, to enter into those new places. In order to enter into the new places, you have to be stupid, because if you go into those new alive places, well, actually all places, but specifically, you know, the koan of certain aspects of our life that are more charged or problematic or relentlessly available to us, you have to become stupid. You know, it's like in order to enter a place of not of numbness, right? Especially if you don't like being stupid. I don't like being stupid. I don't like to be out of it. I mean, I spend a lot of time there. You'd think I'd make friends with it more. But I often try to say, well, that's what's wrong with me, and deny that, and then get back to being strong or clear or hard training or persevering or something. But to actually consciously enter into that place of deer in the headlights or numbness or awkwardness or stupidity, it's like feeling in the wall for a light switch and you don't know where it is. You know, you get up at night and you're in the room and you're feeling around, especially if it's a room you don't know well, and you're feeling for the light switch. And you don't know where it is, and you're mildly disoriented because you're still half asleep and you're trying to find the light switch. You can panic and then, you know, do all kinds of things. But actually, if you slow down, and feel for it, then, and you don't know where you are, at some point you will be surprised to find the light switch. Right there, you know, something touching. What could this be? Something's touching my hand. It's the light switch. And tick, and you turn on the light. So how to enter into stupid places or numb places? Especially because usually when we're in them, we're numb. Or usually when we're in them, we're enacting the defense of. The defense against being that way, or the whatever it is, and I suppose the defense, there's something wonderfully intelligent about defenses too, because we can enact our own defenses. If you enter into them or mine your defense, you'll find there was a reason you have the defense. There's something inside around it, underneath it, and the defense has an intelligence and is asking you to go a little bit more slowly there, because you're in the heart, you're in very touchy territory. But anyway, what time is it? Oh, it's time to stop. I'm sorry, I'm getting carried away with this whole thing. But an encouragement for us to return and to be a little bit more, you know, experiment, entering into it, you guys. I'm encouraging myself as well. And experiment feeling in the dark in places that you haven't been in order to explore. And an encouragement to be not quite so predictable in your practice, and not quite so thinking that it's a calisthenic or something, a technique that you do in order to get somewhere. So on that note, we'll return to our sitting. Thank you.